All right, now we can go. Or now. Or maybe now. There we go. It's a little tough to do the pre-roll banter when you're all by yourself. I'll tell you what. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the podcast, as you know, about tech, the economy, and culture, where none of us is as smart as all of us. As you might have surmised, I'm all by my lonesome this week, Ms. Wood. Well, I guess she had a prior engagement. No, she's at a conference in Vegas. And as we know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. So I guess we will not be hearing what happened in Vegas. But I'm all by myself, so I get to do whatever I want, which is not technically true. But this one does kind of play to my interest. And it's a little bit of what we've been doing on this podcast the past, I don't know, year, maybe a little longer. And a conversation about two things, really. One is, and this is a little bit of a stretch, but roll with me and you'll see where this is going. Number one is whether capitalism's working for everybody. But number two is about climate change and what is happening there, why in terms of our response, and what can we do about it? And we're going to roll in a little bit of my background today. We're going to roll in aviation, specifically more sustainable aviation, because as you may or may not know, the kerosene-powered fuels that jet engines use and turboprops and all of that, and reciprocating engines for that matter, all use some version of fossil fuels, kerosene-based, JP5, Jet A, take your pick. And the problem is that that's really, really dirty. Now, we're working on that problem on the ground, right, with cars, and you've got Tesla and Chevy Volt and all of that stuff. The question for us today is, can you do that in the air, electric or maybe hybrid airplanes? And the truth is, I don't know, so we've called somebody who will know. His name is Graham Warrick. He's the managing editor of Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine. It's a publication that's been covering the aviation industry for almost as long as there has been an aviation industry. Graham, welcome to Make Me Smart.
Hi there. Good to see you.
So let me ask you this foundational question, first of all. When you say electric airplanes, do people look at you and go, no, come on, seriously?
Even people in the industry look at me and go, no, come on, like, seriously. Less so now than as recently as 5 years ago, you would have got some very strange looks. So if you talk electric, you've got to be very realistic about what you're talking about. You're talking about smaller airplanes, shorter ranges.
So when we're talking electric airplanes, what we're talking about is not like 747s with electric motors, right? We're talking something else.
No. So if you're talking today, you're talking about a small two-seat airplane that can fly for about an hour, which means you can use it for training, just, you know, going round and round, you know, circuits and bumps, as they call it, or you can go out on a Sunday and potter around for an hour or so. That's what you can do today. And then there's the first very small vertical takeoff and landing aircraft that ultimately maybe could be used in a city as air taxis. They're sort of flying today. But this technology, a bit like we've seen with cars, this technology is moving pretty fast. So we're already seeing the first four-seat airplanes flying. Wow. They might be able to, you know, they're small, they're light airplanes, they're not, you know, whatever. But you could use them commercially as air taxis, and they might fly for, you know, 2 or 3 hours. The battery technology is improved enough that you can maybe get 2 or 3 hours out of them. We are beginning to see bigger airplanes starting to move off the drawing board.
All right. So let me ask you a couple of engineering, I guess, questions. First of which is batteries. Number one, they're incredibly heavy, right? And number two, they don't have as much oomph, as it were, as, say, a gallon of JP5.
No, absolutely. I mean, there is a huge difference in the energy content, or the energy density, as they call it, between kerosene and batteries. So it's like about a 20-fold difference between it.
What about, and this is going to sound fundamental again, but what about recharging? How often do you have to plug these things in? I mean, the ones that exist now?
Yeah, it depends how you use them. These light airplanes that you're talking about, most of these airplanes don't fly a lot anyway, you know, even if they're piston powered or turbine powered. You're not talking about, a private airplane may fly 200 or 300 hours a year, you know. So flying an hour and then having it sitting on the ground for the rest of the day recharging really makes no difference. Yeah. You do start to talk about charging becomes an issue when you start talking about urban air mobility, urban air taxis, where you want rapid turnaround. And that technology has to come along, but it is coming along in the automotive. If you're a drive an electric truck, you've got to charge a huge battery very quickly. And that same technology is kind of applicable to airplanes if you need to turn them around quickly.
So I was lucky enough to drive a Tesla for a couple of days. And one of the things that struck me when I was driving this Tesla was that obviously electric battery powered, electric motor, the whole deal. You ease your foot off the accelerator and the car slows down almost immediately, right? There's no coasting, there's no nothing. And I don't want to get too technical here, but if you're playing with the throttles on an electric airplane, you can't have that happen, right? You need some gradation of power.
Yeah, and to be honest, airplanes are not flown the way that cars are. I mean, airplanes, you kind of put the throttle where you want it, and it stays there most of the flight. Actually, electric motors are very well suited to flight. That for two main reasons is, one is that airplane engines tend to run at the same speed for most of the flight. Secondly, engines that breathe air, as you go up in altitude and the air gets thinner, yeah, you get less power out of them. With an electric motor, you get no difference. It's called the lapse rate. You have the same power at altitude as you do as takeoff. And that actually makes a big difference when you start to design an airplane around an electric motor rather than around a turbine engine. If you really, really think about how you use it, you can start to do some clever things.
Do you have a sense, just to the air-breathing engines, as it were, and the gas-breathing engines, do you have a sense of how bad they are carbon emissions-wise?
It depends on how you measure it.
Yeah.
You have to look at it's sort of like the passenger kilometer type, you know, how far is the airplane going? How many people is it carrying? Right. Airplanes are actually a very efficient way of carrying people long distances. So if you look at the total emissions of carrying 300 people across the Atlantic, it's way less than any other way of traveling. But if you're just flying short, you know, training, for example, if you're just going up and down and up and down, or you're just flying very short ranges, you know, that doesn't look so good. So it really depends on what you're doing with the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
But the end result is, the biggest problem the industry has is not really the individual emission of an individual flight. This is a growing industry. You know, there are more and more people flying. So if you just do the math, even if we get better, we get worse because we're growing faster than we're reducing our emissions. Yeah. And that's really the big problem.
So I did a little poking around, obviously, before our chat. And there's some great, cool-looking videos out there and some really inventive forms, I guess, of airplane. We're not talking typical propeller in the nose, dragging you along thing, right? There are quadcopters, or I guess they're octocopters, right? And push propellers as well. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so basically, if you have a conventional combustion engine, whether it's piston or turbine, you have an engine driving one propeller or one fan, and that generates thrust,
right?
Because it's mechanically connected, right? The thing about electric is it allows you to break that connection between the thing that's generating the power and the thing that's using the power. So you can put that fan or that prop or that rotor wherever you want to put it on the airplane, and you can put as many of them as you want. So you can start to do the drone design, the multi-copter drone design. You know, a helicopter's got one rotor. A drone's got eight. There are some air taxis out there that have 18 rotors. Wow. That actually means that if you lose one or two or three of those rotors, it's not disastrous. Whereas if you lose one rotor on a helicopter. So their electric allows you to multiply the number of rotors you have and actually bring safety, you know, increase the level of safety.
Right.
On airplanes, you can put the propellers where they have the best effect. You can actually by putting them at the back of the airplane or tips of the wings or places you can't do it with combustion power, you can actually get the aerodynamics and the propulsion to help each other, and you get a better airplane.
Are we size limited simply by the physics of having to lift heavy things? And I'm just thinking here, the battery that would be required, or batteries that would be required to power a commercial jetliner, seem prohibitive.
It's vast. I mean, to do what an A320, Boeing 737, Airbus A320 does today within the US, say, and then like a 777 or an A320 across the Atlantic or across the Pacific, that is totally and utterly beyond the capacity of a battery to do that, which is why hybrid electric is where most of the focus is. Just like it was with cars initially, until batteries got better, aviation is saying, actually, well, you know, fuel's a pretty good way of storing energy, but we don't have to use it as fuel. We can actually take that fuel, turn it into energy, into electricity, and then use the electricity. And it allows us to get some of the benefits that we've talked about, changes in the way you design, other things like that. So you get some of the benefit of electric, not all of it, but enough to make a difference. To bring emissions down quicker than we could by just continually pushing turbine technology, for example.
Yeah, lots of talk in the material that I read and the poking around that I did about how well-suited this technology would be for autonomous aircraft. What do you think?
Yeah, they're kind of separate, but they're kind of the same. I mean, you know, it's just that the technologies kind of suit each other because if you think about it, if you have a big mechanical thing like an engine, it's hard to digitalize that, to make that into a software thing. But if you have electric and you're moving electrons around in an airplane, it's very easy to then just use software to do things you would have done mechanically in the past. And obviously, you know, software, then you bring the autonomy in and you can do all sorts of clever things because you're now bringing the control together with the aerodynamics, together with the propulsion, and you're using software to merge all that, optimize all that. So they kind of go together.
All right, so two last questions, and then I'll let you go. The first one is market forces, right? There's been talk recently of the, you know, flight shaming and emissions from aircraft are too much and people need to find greener ways to travel. Do you think market forces will drive this, as it seems that market forces are driving electric vehicles on the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. Now it's going to work slightly differently. We can't move to electric quickly enough to make really any near-term difference. So what aviation is going to do first is go to synthetic fuels that you make from waste products, or you take the carbon dioxide from the air and you turn it into fuel. All these things we can do. So the near-term focus is synthetic fuels. Doesn't reduce the amount that we emit at the time that we emit it, but it reduces the life cycle carbon, and that's the big thing. Now, as that's happening, then yes, they want to move to electric, probably hybrid, but if it's urban, if it's regional, if it's private aviation, then that could go all electric within a decade. But definitely market forces are pushing hard on this.
Okay, here's the flip side of that coin, though, and I'm sure you have greater insight than I do. Convincing people to get on an electric airplane.
Right? Yeah, it's a complex mix. You mentioned autonomy. So in a lot of these new business models that we're looking at, it's a combination of electric and autonomy and other things. Airplanes that don't look like airplanes look today.
Yep.
We have got a lot of work to do to convince people that those things are safe. And that work is being done, but that's why it takes time. That's why the electric piece of this will take a decade or two. Because you have to write new rules for safety. The fuel bit, the synthetic fuel bit of that, we can do within the rules that exist today. So that's what's going to pace how quickly we move.
Graham Warrick, he's the managing editor at Aviation Week and Space Technology Magazine. Graham, thank you so much. Totally enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
Take care. All right. So look, would you get on an electric plane? I probably would, but I'm not the use case here for most people. Let us know what you think. Send us a voicemail, makemesmart@marketplace.org, and tell us, well, first of all, if you buy into that whole flight shaming thing, or if you just get on a plane and go where you're going, and what you would want to see before you would get on an electric plane. Let us know, makemesmart@marketplace.org. We'll be back in a second.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
All right, we're back once again. It's just me. Sorry, no Molly. no Molly. But I will channel my inner Molly Wood and just offer this as our news item for the day, and you guys can chew on this. It continues the banana pants saga of the WeWork company. And I'll just read the headline from Bloomberg today, and it goes like this. WeWork is in the early stages of forming an electronic gaming arm. You know, right? Right? If Molly were here, she'd be all over this. All right. Enough for me. You guys, go.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, continuing with the theme of climate change and what to do about it and how we might adapt or lessen the impact, we did a thing a couple of weeks ago now probably on nuclear power. Had a good conversation, got some good feedback, which we are still getting. Here's Ian Gateson with his two cents.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Ian from Winnipeg. I appreciated your recent episode on nuclear power. However, human beings do a terrible job of cleaning up after themselves. I could refer you to the recent piece on Marketplace, which mentioned synthetic indigo pollution in Vietnam. Or I could refer you to the abandoned couch in the vacant lot at the end of my street. We've traded paper for plastic and saved the trees, and now plastic pollution is present in all major water bodies on Earth. If we install mini nuclear reactors all over the world to fight climate change and trade carbon dioxide for solid radioactive waste, realistically, how do you think that's going to go?
Exactly. I'm pretty sure that's what I was saying, right? Wind is wind. Solar is the sun. Nuclear is radioactive. I think that is an underappreciated problem. Actually, that's not true. I'm sure everybody appreciates it, but it's a huge dilemma. And it goes, oh, by the way, just to square the circle here, back to that whole consumer acceptance thing I was talking about with electric airplanes, right? How are you going to convince people to accept, you know, neighborhood nuclear power if the waste lasts for 10,000 years? Okay. Now to the get off my lawn portion of this program. Talked about Megan McCarty Carino's piece that she did for Marketplace about generational miscommunication in the workplace now that we have so many older workers working alongside so many younger workers, especially when it comes to texting or punctuation in your written communication. This one comes from Donna Gordon. Here you go.
I am not a boomer. I am a millennial, but I'm going to take Kai Rizdal's side on this one with the K versus the KK.
Yay.
Personally, I find KK to be abrupt and dismissive. It's like, KK, go away. You can stop now. I don't use K either because we are no longer in the days where you have to push your keypad button three times to get a single letter on the screen. If you can type a whole email on your phone, you can type, okay, thank you, see you later, with proper punctuation. And that is what I do.
Let me just tell you, so I set up the story last week. I set up my news fix last week by talking about my 21-year-old college senior son and how he had said to me 6 months ago, Dad, your punctuation is really abrupt. So I shared the podcast with him. I texted him, intentionally didn't do any punctuation, right? I did the whole KK thing. I did everything like I was supposed to do. And let me just say, also, get off my lawn. The kid, he doesn't even like actually text me back. He just does that thing where you hold your thumb down on the text and you get the exclamation point thing. That's what he did. That's what he did. Okay. Same subject, more serious response. John Maluso, who is pursuing a PhD in miscommunication. Here you go.
Hi, this is John Maluso. I'm a doctoral candidate at the University of Michigan. So I sincerely appreciated Kai's coverage of miscommunication last week. My dissertation is on miscommunication in organizations and how even these seemingly trivial examples of differences in understandings can have a significant impact on organizational performance. Many people are probably familiar with some of the high-profile examples, like how these quote-unquote communication problems contributed to the cultures, both at NASA during the Challenger and Columbia space shuttle disasters. Or a more recent example, last year's ballistic missile false alarm in Hawaii involved several instances of miscommunication in the organization responsible for managing these systems and led people to fear for their lives for 38 minutes. Anyway, thank you so much for your coverage of this important subject because it would help all of us to give a little more attention to the multiple meanings of all of our communication.
I'm sure John has it, but I would love to see the data on organizational efficiency decline because of miscommunications about like K versus KK. I'm just saying. All right, We got to go. That's it. We're doing it short because it's just me. And, you know, I've still got a cold and I don't sound good and all that stuff. Anyway, thanks for listening. Subscribe to the newsletter. We'll post a link to it, as we always do in the show notes. Marketplace.org/newsletters is where you go so you don't miss one. Subscribe. They are really, really good. Erica Phillips writes them. Props to her. And that's where we are. All right. Now I have to wait. I still have to wait. Okay. Now I can go. Make Me Smart was produced and directed this week by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to the video crew, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore. Thanks to Christian Buckler in Washington, D.C. for recording video there and getting Graham Warwick set up. The program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Atar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. I'm who I am. Molly's not here. Is she back next week? Is Molly back next week? You know what's happening? I don't think Molly's back next week. She is, but I'm not. Or am I? Are we recording early? I got to travel next week. I don't even know. All right. We're recording Monday. Now you guys know. Sneak peek. I'm big on, you know, going behind the fourth wall. Breaking the fourth wall, behind the curtain. Make up your mind, guy. Got to go. Bye. Yeah. Have you ever driven an electric car?
No, I have not. Been run over by one, but not driven. Yeah.
Okay, that's a whole different podcast, I imagine.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.